Good evening, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Tonight, we're going to talk about insects. Have you ever wondered what all those bugs are doing in your garden? Today, we're going to find out. My guest is Azucena Lucatero, a third-year PhD student in Dr. Stacy Philpott's lab at UC Santa Cruz. Lucatero studies the socio-ecology of urban gardens in the California across the California Central Coast, with special interests in biological pest control, community and population ecology, landscape ecology, and food justice. Azucena Lucatero, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Hi.
It's good to have you on the show. And this is a somewhat serendipitous interview, since I just did a show with Orrin Martin a couple of weeks ago. You remember? He manages the garden and also works at the UC Santa Cruz farm. And we mentioned your work in passing. And I saw that you're a member of Stacy Philpott's Bugs Project, which stands for Biodiversity in Urban Gardens. And somewhere I came up with a notion of the socio-ecology of insects in urban gardens, and maybe that was from you. So at any rate, why don't we start? Can you tell us what bugs is and how it got started?
Yeah, so you got it exactly right. Bugs stands for Biodiversity in Urban Gardens, and that's what we investigate in a nutshell. It's the now 7 or 8 year project that my advisor, Stacy Philpott, started. And Stacy tells me that the project was inspired by a University of Michigan grad student who was surveying the biodiversity of urban gardens in Detroit, Michigan. And that student was interested in comparing the Detroit gardens to gardens elsewhere too. So at that time, Stacy was in Toledo, Ohio, where she started out as a professor and decided to survey the biodiversity of gardens there. And when she came over to Santa Cruz, she brought the garden project with her, and it's expanded now over the years. It includes over 20 gardens in 3 counties, Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, and Monterey. And it's been funded by the USDA over the past few years. Our team includes professors and students at the University of Texas at Austin, Seattle University, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization of Australia, and UC Santa Cruz, of course.
That's quite a spread.
And
what are the goals of the project then? I mean, why study urban gardens and the insects that populate them?
So the overall goal is to understand how urban community gardens function as refuges for biodiversity, including plants and insects, and how we support the well-being of gardeners and cities. So we know that gardens act as habitats for biodiversity, and we try to understand how different regimes of garden management and the different compositions of the urban landscape impact those species that make up the biodiversity and the ecosystem services that species contribute to people. So we try to do this by measuring the garden habitat, including the diversity of crops that people plant, how frequently they weed and water their gardens, and the kind and amount of ground cover that they might use, including mulch, and what kinds of canopy cover they might include, like trees and bushes. So we work in urban community gardens in the California Central Coast and have tried to select gardens that represent the different degrees of urbanization and the resulting diversity of the landscapes present in our region. So some gardens are surrounded by more impervious ground cover, like blacktop, which tends to be bad for insects and biodiversity. And some include agricultural fields and remnant natural habitats like forests and grasslands and the landscape surrounding them. And socially, the gardens are pretty representative of the region. The gardener population includes multiple nationalities and spoken languages and a wider range of incomes and levels of formal education. And actually, when our survey team conducted surveys with the gardeners in 2017, we managed to carry out surveys in English, Spanish, Korean, and Serbian. And that was based on the language skills of our team. We probably could have conducted more languages.
Huh. And what sorts of things do the gardeners raise then?
Mostly crops, and a lot of the time, the cultural background of the gardener has a big influence on the crop types that they include in their plots. So gardeners from Latin American heritages will include corn, beans, squash, peppers, while gardeners from Asian heritages can include more eggplant and bitter melon, things that you might see at the Asian grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But they also include medicinal herbs and flowers as well.
So here's an ecology, maybe it's an ecology or biodiversity question. I can't think of what it is. But you could say that gardens represent forms of invasive species, correct? Because most of them don't exist around here. And mm-hmm. how does that affect the insect population, you know, the diversity and the insects that get drawn to the gardens?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I haven't looked at this question very closely myself, but I can say that based on the work of other members in our lab, the presence of native pollinators is likely affected. But despite that, we do find a big diversity of pollinators in our gardens, including bumblebees and wild bees. So while gardens do include many non-native plant species, they might function as novel habitats that support existing species and probably do support species that are non-native as well. So it's a complicated set of species. But overall, the gardeners enjoy them and the insects enjoy them as well.
Yeah, I would imagine. So usually, you know, I raise that term socioecology, right, or social ecology. And usually mm-hmm. the way that we speak about that is to address the interplay of human social systems and practices with natural mm-hmm. biological and ecological beings and systems. And of course, urban gardens are examples of such interplay. Gardeners basically shape the biological context, right, in which the insects live and thrive or don't thrive. So, you know, if you had to define the term, how would you define the socio-ecology of insects?
I would define it as the system of interactions between people and insects and the multiple feedbacks between them. So in the gardens, I like to think about them as made up of interactions between species, including people whose management decisions shape the garden habitat.
Right.
And starting very simply, people plant crops, which attracts insects. And those insects that colonize the garden can be species that are beneficial, like pollinators, or species that gardeners want on their crops, like herbivorous pests. And so, thankfully, there are natural enemies of the pests that are also attracted to the gardens. And the natural enemies are the predators of pest species that naturally, through their hunting and feeding strategies, help keep the herbivore populations in check.
Mm-hmm.
And we call this ecosystem service biological pest control. So
yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
In the garden...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. In the gardens, we tend to find lots of different natural enemies, and probably the ones that are most visible and abundant and that gardeners have probably observed are ladybugs that are predatory, spiders, ants, and parasitic wasps.
Mm-hmm. And what are they going after?
The prey that they prefer, like ladybugs, especially like aphids,
yeah.
but also other soft-bodied herbivores like mealybugs or mites.
Mm-hmm.
guys are pretty gentle, and they catch a little bit of everything in their webs, or maybe some of them hunt along the ground and don't use webs as much. And actually, parasitic wasps are more specialist, so they tend to go for one particular prey species that they've co-evolved with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, let's switch the topic now and talk a little bit about you. What motivated you to come to environmental studies at UCSC?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the short answer is that I came to UCSC because of my advisor, Dr. Stacy Philpott. And the longer answer is that UCSC ticked off the three main boxes that I was considering when I was making my grad school decision. And those were a good match with the advisor, how possible it was to do interdisciplinary research, and how supportive the environment was for students of color.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I actually heard about Stacy and UCSC's program through an undergrad mentor of mine named Teresa Ong. And I worked with her as part of a summer research opportunity I did at the University of Michigan. And when I was there, my mentor Teresa was a graduate student doing urban agroecology research in the gardens of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And through her, I developed an interest in agroecology that persisted over time. And it was Teresa that suggested when I was looking up graduate programs that I consider working with Stacy. And Stacy was advised by the same PhD advisor as Teresa, so I would be staying in the same academic family with a similar approach towards studying agroecology, which is focused on insects and the ecology of agricultural systems, but informed by an understanding of the social and political dimensions of those systems, and also invested in just outcomes for the growers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I visited Stacy's lab, her students told me how wonderful she was as an advisor, and I got a sense of that myself too. And I was encouraged by the fact that Stacy's students were diverse and included women of color who were very happy with her. And that's always a good sign that an advisor is aware of the demographic disparities in academia and their field of study specifically, and more than that, that she's doing something to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So for all of those reasons, I came to UC Santa Cruz.
Did you consider any place else, or were you targeted only at UC Santa Cruz? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, so I applied to 7 programs in total.
Okay.
Most of them were single discipline programs, ecological science programs.
Yeah.
And my top contenders ended up being UC Santa Cruz and the Frontiers Master's Program at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tough choice, but ultimately I wanted to do interdisciplinary research and work in the urban setting. And Stacy was a great match, and I'm happy with where I ended up.
Well, certainly, I know from experience, it's certainly possible to do interdisciplinary work in environmental studies and across the campus more generally. We need to take a short break. So you're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming on the Internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Azucena Lucatero, a third-year PhD student at UC Santa Cruz, who studies, among other things, the social ecology of insects in urban gardens. So let's talk about your PhD research. So what are you focused on in your doctoral research, you know, and what does that involve in terms of, I guess, going out into the field?
Yeah. So my PhD research focuses on the fundamental interactions that I've been telling you about required to maintain biological pest control in the urban garden. So those are the interactions between people, plants, and insects. And I study these interactions mainly by conducting fieldwork, where I survey the vegetation, the ground cover, and the insect community in the garden. We also measure predation in the gardens through field experiments. So we do this by bringing in what we call sentinel plants, kind of like the canary in the coal mine.
Huh.
And for us, they're the potted plants that we grow in the greenhouse. And we then bring them into the garden and place prey items on them.
You place what on them?
Prey items.
Uh-huh.
Like we've used in the past aphids and moth eggs.
Oh, I see.
To simulate the presence of herbivores.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we bring those sentinel plants into the gardens and then leave them overnight. We cover half of them with a fine mesh, like bridal veil almost,
mm-hmm.
to exclude the natural enemies so that they can't access the herbivores inside. And then the other half, we leave them unwrapped so that the natural enemies can access the prey. Then we come back, pick them up, count the number of prey items on the plants with clickers. We actually count them twice, when we drop them off and then again when we pick them up. And the difference in the number of prey items before and after the plants spend time in the garden tells us how many prey have been removed and gives us an estimate of the level of predation that the natural enemies in the garden provide. So that's a taste of the ecological aspect of my research. The social science aspect involves interacting with the gardeners and conducting interviews with them on their gardening practices and ecological knowledge of the biodiversity in the garden. That part actually hasn't happened for me yet. I'm planning to carry it out over the summer. But in short, every gardener makes observations of the nature in their gardens. And their accumulation of those observations in a particular place over time is called local ecological knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in learning about the different kinds of local ecological knowledge that gardeners have as a precursor to their interactions with the biodiversity in the garden.
Have you found anything? I know you said you were going to do the interviews this summer, but do you have any kind of preliminary examples or to tell us, you know, what would local knowledge look like?
Mm-hmm. So every time we go into the gardens, the gardeners that we happen to encounter, they tell us about that they've noticed that they have herbivores that are a problem. And they ask us how we might recommend that they manage them. And we don't always have a precise answer, but the fact that they're noticing, that is a first step to figuring out what this herbivore is doing and maybe what other insects are interacting with it through predation. And noticing is really the basic element of local ecological knowledge.
Yeah. Do you give them recommendations about what to do? Or do you just explain to them what's going on?
Well, first of all, I preface by telling them that they absolutely know more than
about
what's happening in their gardens. But I do provide some general guidelines. Like I typically recommend that they consider growing more flowers, which tend to provide alternative resources for the predators, because besides prey, they also need habitat for nesting and foraging. And a lot of the natural enemies also feed off of the nectar of flowers.
Yeah.
So flowers are always a good thing to include in their gardens. They might also, gardens already have a leg up with plant diversity. But diversifying their crops can help. That tends to be associated with more natural enemies in the gardens. Those are the two major things that I always recommend.
Well, so I have a sort of a trick question. It's not meant to be a trick, but if you're studying the presence of natural enemies in gardens, and you then introduce more plant species, right? Are you not sort of changing the conditions of your research project?
Yeah, well, and we expect that the garden ecosystems are dynamic over time, and they change almost every month depending on what people are planting, what they've harvested, especially over the summer when the gardens are most active. And that dynamicism is part of what we're interested in capturing. So we do our vegetation surveys every time we go to the gardens, every time we're doing an experiment, so that the vegetation data we have most closely matches what's in the garden at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Bugs Project issues an annual report of its activities, and the 2019 report was just issued. You kindly sent it to me. And so, mm-hmm. so I was reading through it, and I saw that some degree of garden messiness affects what kind of insects show up in gardens. Mm-hmm. And you, the report talked about problems with mulching. And so I wonder if you could talk about that, about the idea of messiness as opposed to order in gardens, mm-hmm. and how that, you know, helps bring in natural enemies.
Yeah. So messiness, we think about in multiple ways. It can be allowing more weeds to exist in your garden, which increases the amount of vegetation diversity in your garden.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that provides more habitat structure and resources. So we consider it a good thing. And we've looked at it in a few different ways in the gardens. One of the things that comes up again and again is the presence of mulch, which we tend to focus on the wood chip kind.
Yeah,
I know there's a few different types. So adding mulch into the gardens can make it look very neat and tidy, but it also changes the habitat structure of the ground and mm-hmm. helps maintain the soil humidity in the ground. The wood chips themselves provide burrowing habitat for crawling insects that hunt on the ground, like spiders, and our work previously has found positive correlations between the mulch and spider activity and species diversity of the spiders. So mulch provides a cover for the bare soil that decreases the soil temperatures and prevents the water evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be good for species like spiders that prefer microclimates that are humid and cool.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also found in the past that the presence of mulch correlates with less lady beetle diversity. And we don't know exactly why for the ladybug, but it might be if eucalyptus mulch is being used, the eucalyptus oil that naturally occurs in the mulch. That's been found to repel some insects and ladybugs. They might be one of those insects repelled by it. But overall, the effect of adding the mulch is that the makeup of the species in the insect community changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that matters because some species are better predators than others. And some combinations of species can have a synergistic effect on the biological pest control of herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
If they, for example, some of them are predators that focus on the upper levels of the vegetation and some of them focus on the ground. And together, they control a larger diversity of the herbivores on the crops. But sometimes combinations of natural enemies don't work as well together. For example, if they have antagonistic interactions between them, like a larger predator preying on a smaller predator, leading to less effective biological pest control. So in short, messiness matters because it changes the types of insects that show up in the garden, and that has an effect on biological pest control.
Mm-hmm. And so what sorts of messiness are best?
I think
I'm thinking about the recommendation to farmers, you know, larger uh-huh. farmers, that they include, and maybe strawberries as well, that they include strips of grasses mm-hmm. and things between fields, right, as a way to try and attract predators, right, on bad bugs, right? And, I mean, is this the kind mm-hmm. of thing that you mean when you talk about messiness?
Yeah, messiness really means increasing the diversity of management practices in the garden. So that can look, especially in, on farms,
yeah,
that kind of look like strips of flowers, which just are not as common in the fields of one single crop.
Right.
So that's a big benefit to those fields. And in gardens, which already have a lot of diversity, it can be a little trickier to figure out exactly what kind of increase might optimize the insect community if you're trying to optimize biological pest control. But we can say that in gardens that are surrounded by a more heavily urbanized landscape, those gardens are actually even more important as green spaces and refuges for the biodiversity, because there just aren't as many resources for natural enemies in the surrounding mm-hmm. landscape. So improving the habitat in those gardens through additions of flower, by allowing more weeds to persist, by diversifying the ground cover and the crops, all of that is especially important in those gardens in more urban landscapes.
Mm-hmm. Just apropos that, I'm wondering, do you pay attention to the density of insects in these gardens? And have you noticed, or has the project noticed, any kind of secular decline in the numbers of insects that come to urban gardens?
We have noticed that in gardens with more diversity of crops, there tends to be more diversity of species in general.
Right,
and
sure.
When you look at vegetation density alone, herbivores that have an abundant amount of the plant that they prefer to feed on are more abundant there, definitely. Declines overall, well, the gardens in more urban landscapes do tend to have less insects in general, but those are the only broad patterns, and we tend to focus a little bit more on these smaller components of the habitat and how they influence different species.
The reason I asked was that one of my colleagues here at the station just mentioned how she used to scrape bugs off the front of her family's car after they had gone somewhere.
Oh, wow.
And that doesn't happen anymore, which seems to be an indicator of sort of secular decline in insect populations. Mm. I was just wondering about that. It doesn't really have much to do with your research. We need to take another short break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now. My guest tonight is Azucena Lucatero, a third-year PhD student in Dr. Stacey Philpott's lab at UC Santa Cruz and a participant in Stacey Philpott's BUGS project, which stands for Biodiversity in Urban Gardens. And we've just been talking about the role of messiness and disorder in providing habitat for various kinds of enemies, right? Insect enemies, enemies of the bad of the bad bugs, right? So another in that report that I mentioned earlier, it said that in the summer of 2019, you looked at the impacts of garden plot complexity on herbivores and their natural enemies. So what is complexity in this context, and can you tell us something about that work and how it relates to your PhD?
Yeah, habitat complexity is the size, density, diversity, and arrangement of all the different habitat components, including the living and non-living ones. And so the project that I did in 2019 was my attempt to consider the interactions between plants and insects in the garden. So for my purposes, I focused on how garden vegetation and individual gardener plots can contribute to vegetation complexity and what the effects of that were on the community of insect herbivores and natural enemies. So for that project, I measured habitat complexity as the density of the vegetation, the diversity of the vegetation, and the connectivity of the vegetation. So how closely the plants are arranged and how connected the vegetation overall was. Based on ecological theory, I expected that more vegetation density would lead to more herbivores, as I mentioned to you, because habitats with more of an abundance of the preferred food of an herbivore are going to attract more herbivores. And then, on the other hand, I expected that vegetation diversity would lead to more natural enemies because the diverse crop assemblages tend to include a greater diversity of prey species and alternative resources, like those suitable nesting and foraging habitats, and the nectar that supports the greater diversity of natural enemies. And as far as vegetation connectivity, I expected that more connected plots would help natural enemies move around the gardener's plot and improve their ability to find and hunt their prey, which would lead to fewer herbivores. And as far as the results, I haven't finished a full analysis of the data yet, but so far I have found that more habitat complexity, including those three vegetation components I described, is positively correlated with the natural enemy diversity and can potentially improve biological pest control. And I also found... I also found that different amounts of vegetation complexity were associated with slightly different natural enemy communities, which may also impact biological pest control. So while I can't say exactly how, I can say that it is happening.
So, you know, all of us who do gardening buy seed packets, right? And or potato sets and things like that, right? And the instructions always basically say lay out a row, you know, and I think this is a very sort of English obsession, right? The orderly garden. But when Oren was here last week, we talked 2 weeks ago, we talked about, you know, Alan Chadwick's biodynamic gardening and Whiskey Hill Farms down in Watsonville, who I've, you know, interviewed a couple of times, people I've interviewed a couple of times, does this sort of polyculture, which is the layering of different crops at different heights. And so, you know, and there's this question about messiness. I mean, is it really necessary to plant orderly gardens? Would a disorderly garden, say, be better in terms of predators, you know, on plant enemies, on plant or on herbivores and the like? Have you observed any gardens like that?
Yeah, so the gardens, because they're community gardens that include multiple different gardeners, they each manage their plot in different ways. And actually, some of the, especially gardeners with Latin American heritage, they can include something that resembles the milpa system from Mexico.
Can you explain? Why don't you just explain that, for our listeners?
So the milpa system is a traditional system that includes corn as the grain in the system, and it's tall and provides some shade. It also includes beans, which run up the corn. The corn provides its structure for the beans to run up. And then the squash, or the beans can also provide nitrogen through the nitrogen fixation that legumes provide in the system. And the squash also benefits from the structure that the corn provides, since that one is a bushy crop that also tends to run up structures. So this system, it's diverse. But diversity doesn't always mean better. It depends on the components of the system and how well they work together. So finding the combinations that work best and support each other through these ecological functions, like structure and nitrogen fixation, that comes from local ecological knowledge and the observation that these species work well together, which in that system was passed down over centuries and extends to the present day.
Have you found any other examples of that kind of sort of co-planting? Not, you know, other than the milpa system, amongst any of the gardeners?
None that I've known the ecological functions of necessarily, but I do see that gardeners try to build little interlocking systems that sometimes include rows, but like gardeners will include wooden stakes that help support some of those plants that need the structure to support them, and then grow plants under that. So there is an inclination to do this, and maybe the messiness or disorderliness of it isn't always the culprit in increasing the diversity and just making sure the system works well together. But I think there's a lot of possibility and a lot that we don't know yet. And certainly in many traditional systems to draw from for inspiration.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, one thing that motivates gardeners to do that is the limitations on space, right? I think, again, English gardens probably evoke lords of the manor, right, with lots of space in which to plant things. And urban gardens, by and large, are not that large. Well, I know that food justice is one of the focuses of your research. And so how does that figure in?
So urban gardening is in part about access to food. It's also about community and connection to nature, but for the food part, in a survey of the gardeners that we worked with, access to fresh organic food was the most frequently cited motivation for people's gardening. And our survey also found that gardeners do harvest substantial amounts of produce. And access to those fresh foods is especially important for communities that face food insecurity. And in the California Central Coast region where we're in, farm worker communities report high rates of food insecurity, despite providing the essential labor of harvesting the fields and helping to put food on the tables of the nation. So access to food through gardening is important for them and also for communities that don't have nearby grocery stores and have been systematically excluded from access to these fresh foods. I do think it's important to note that while gardening can help improve food security, it's not accessible to everyone. The community gardens that we work with only have so many plots, and many have very long waiting lists.
Yeah.
So overall, food security is a complex issue that requires systemic action, and those solutions can include community gardening, but they should also include state action and social support.
Yeah, I know that that access is part of the problem, right? That there are limited spaces that can be turned into urban gardens, either because who the property owners are, right, or because of various restrictions, but there's lots of, I mean, there is lots of available space that could be cultivated. And, you know, in some ways it seems a shame that it's just sort of left fallow, you know, and unproductive. I think I probably mentioned on the show once before that I've had a vision of turning all front lawns and streets into gardens, you know, and what would that take? I've seen a couple of efforts to do things like that, but that, of course, requires tearing up the streets, which wouldn't be very popular. So since we're talking about summer research, how did you spend last summer and this past year of lockdown?
Yeah. So last summer, we decided not to attempt to resume the field work in the gardens. Because of the risk that COVID poses to our research team and to the gardeners. But I had plenty to keep me busy. We've accumulated so much data over the years that needed analyzing. I worked on that. I also had some applications to write for funding and for permission to do my human subjects interviews with the gardeners.
Right.
I did take on a greenhouse project, which I was able to conduct in a socially distant manner. And that one was looking at lady beetle behavior under different vegetation complexity treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the wildfires hit and cut that project a little bit short, but I have some exciting data to analyze now and some very cute videos of lady beetles voraciously attacking and eating aphids. They're very good predators.
Have you posted those anywhere online, the videos?
I haven't yet, but I would be willing to.
Yeah, yeah, you should do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's probably a great hunger, pardon the pun, for, you know, various kinds of you know, information and advice about urban gardening. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and ksquid.org streaming on the internet. You are listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Azucena Lucatera. She is a third-year PhD student who is doing work on the biological pest control, community and population ecology, landscape ecology, and food justice in California Central Coast urban gardens. I do have one question about that. What mm-hmm. constitutes an urban garden? I mean, if you know, someone living up in the mountains with no near neighbors, is that that doesn't mm-hmm. count? Does that count as an urban garden?
Well, if they're in the city, that technically qualifies as urban gardening.
Uh-huh.
So it's a simple definition, and I guess it can be influenced by what we consider urban, which can differ from place to place, but simple definition, it includes, can allow for a big diversity of gardens look like.
I mean, I guess that's a socio-ecological question, right? How you define mm-hmm. what's urban and what's not. But I did want to ask, how much of your work and of Bug's work do you think can be applied to small farms around the Central Coast? And I'm thinking of 20 acres or less, which are, of course, much, much mm-hmm. larger than urban gardens. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the research that you're doing and your findings are applicable to larger peri-urban farms?
Yeah, it's possible. I think in general, the big lesson of urban gardens is diversifying crop systems, which small farms could do either in space or over time. And in particular, small farms have much more space to work with, so they might more easily implement strategies that provide alternative resources for natural enemies in strategic locations like the borders of their fields.
Mm-hmm.
Like you mentioned, planting strips of flowers is one evidence-based strategy that farmers can use to attract natural enemies. And there's a few other ones too. They might also consider planting plants known to repel the major herbivores of their crop, or plants that tend to trap herbivores by having them consume a plant that they really prefer and leaving their field mostly intact.
Well, you know, of course, even small farmers are motivated by markets and demand, right? They mm-hmm. they produce a few crops for which there is a demand, as opposed to being, you know, much more diverse than mm-hmm. the much more diverse urban gardens. Have you talked to any of these small farmers or worked with them? I'm just curious because I have an interest in farms at that scale.
Yeah. I haven't talked to them myself, but I do have lab mates who are thinking about small changes under the constraints that small farmers face that they can make to attract insects. My lab mate, Suzanne Lipton, is looking at the community of dung beetles on pastures and what farmers can do to improve the diversity of dung beetles and improve the carbon storage of their field.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Is anyone else in the lab doing any kind of work like that?
Suzanne is the only one in the more rural system right now. In the past, we have had students work in coffee agroforestry in Mexico.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the other big component of my advisor's research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm hoping there are many urban gardeners listening to this particular broadcast. So what kinds of, you've made many recommendations, but if listeners called up and said, you know, what should we do? What kind of mm-hmm. recommendations would you make about cultivating beneficial insects in their gardens?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would recommend that they really empower themselves to make those observations about what insects are in their garden and to pay attention to what natural enemies might be naturally occurring and what things might help support them, because they're the ones who are in their gardens every day and just have a much more close association than we do as researchers. But in general, I would recommend including flowers. If you're like, I just keep bringing in the flowers.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure. What kind of flowers, by the way?
Kind of crops.
What are the best kinds of flowers?
Well, I think any kind of flower would be helpful, but in the past, we've worked with alyssums and other sorts of easy-to-maintain flowers, mm-hmm. especially if gardeners aren't coming to their garden as often.
Uh-huh.
Flowers that are maybe easier, don't have to be watered as often, could be helpful.
Yeah.
Perhaps gardeners might also be interested in purchasing commercially available natural enemies and releasing them in their gardens. Ladybugs and praying mantises are pretty common in garden stores, and that could be one way to introduce more natural enemies if they're really lacking in their gardens.
Mm-hmm. So, in a way, what you're doing is kind of citizen science, right? And do you provide gardeners with any kind of record-keeping materials or anything like that?
Not yet, but my planned project for the summer includes a photo voice component where I plan to be working with gardeners to document their gardens and uh-huh. the biodiversity through cameras,
mm-hmm.
Which most people have available on their phones.
Right, right.
But I can help them arrange a camera pickup if they don't have one. And there's actually a lot of apps on our phones these days that can help us identify the species in our gardens and understand them a little better.
Of course, it can be a little bit awkward gardening with a phone in your hand. I'm just thinking about, you know, there's all this marvelous stuff available, but on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's not necessarily all that convenient in the form that it exists now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any kinds of, are you going to develop any kinds of handbooks based on your research, on the bugs research, you know, advice for urban gardeners and the like?
Yeah, I do hope to create a little photo gallery that I can share online. I am, especially these days of the pandemic, I am a little bit more active on social media and
yeah. mm-hmm.
would like to create materials that can be shared more easily. So it would be fun to create things that are Instagrammable.
Yeah. It would be. Well, yeah, I mean, you can do little instructional videos, I suppose, and send them out over mm-hmm. TikTok or something like that. I have to admit that this is far beyond my capabilities, being...
Even TikTok is a little young for me.
Is it? Oh, well, yeah. I just pull things out of the ether. Well, mm-hmm. look, what are you going to do after you finish your PhD?
Well, I would like to be a professor at a university, as I think many grad students would. I find that the mentoring component is especially compelling for me. I like helping the next generation of scholars and researchers along their path, especially as a way to give back to my communities and just to pass forward the mentorship that I received from mostly women.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I have heard, well, that the academic job market is rough and getting rougher. So I would be open to careers that would let me do research and teach agroecology in other ways, too. But I think universities are the place where the opportunity is most abundant, but the jobs can be tough.
Yeah, well, I will weigh in here with my observation, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, lots of research goes on at universities, and it doesn't often get translated onto the ground, so to speak, right? I know that there's research going on urban gardens, but it's difficult to find, you know, good mm-hmm. work that can really be then sort of transferred. Especially because of differences in local conditions. Have you given any thought to working for, you know, something like a resource conservation district or, you know, agricultural mm-hmm. organizations that are in this business of helping, you know, gardeners and small farmers? Does that look like a possibility? And that way yeah. you can, I'm mentoring now, right? I shouldn't be doing mm-hmm. this. I mean, that way, of course, you can translate that work into application, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But so anyway, I mean, that was just a, just my
That's
thoughts.
Always the challenge for academic work. Our output is measured in research publications,
right.
which are not very accessible to the public. So it is important to think about ways that we can work outside of that box through outreach to the public. And Stacy's annual report is one way that we try to do that, but I can definitely try to work some more on that myself.
Yeah, well, I do wish you luck in your work and your endeavors, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now. I think
thank you for inviting me.
It's been very informative and educational show. So if you gardeners out there want to find out more about biodiversity in urban gardens, you can visit www.urbangardenecology.com, which is the specific website of the Bugs Project. And from there, of course, you can go in all kinds of different directions to read about research and other things related to the project. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m., which is even earlier than Climate One. And if you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, amongst other podcast sites. I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to thank all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station, and especially Christine Barrington, who has been helping me with making phone connections. So until every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.